From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in a bidding war. Let's take a look at some of the houses for sale in some of Rochester's hottest neighborhoods. We're going to start in the South Wedge. Here's 1075 South Clinton Avenue in the South Wedge. In 2012, this house sold for $99,000. In 2017, it went from $99,000 to $150,000. Today, it's listed for $229,000. 205 Henrietta Street in the South Wedge, sold in 2013 for $56,000. Today it's listed for $169,900. Take a tour of Mulberry Street, one of the most popular streets in the neighborhood. Every house on the street is estimated around $250,000, more than twice what the homes were listing for about a decade ago. One of the larger homes right in the middle of the street, three bedrooms, 1.5 baths, sold for $130,000 in 2004. The current estimate is double that price. And that's before the inevitable bidding war that is pushing some South Wedge homes north of $300,000. How about North Winton Village? It's another popular neighborhood where prices have more than doubled in a decade. Right now, you can put in an offer on 180 Merwin Avenue. It's a lovely house, 1,700 square feet, three bedrooms, two bathrooms. Here's the history on this home. 2008, sold for $105,000. 2017, $149,000. Today it's listed at $190,000. The offers will undoubtedly come in well above $200,000 for that house. Beechwood, so many other neighborhoods have seen this pull upwards on prices. In some ways, there are good things about that, especially if this was a city and a housing market that's been underpriced for a long time. You know, you always hear that you get a lot of house for your money. But in other ways, it's a question of what happens when so many city neighborhoods are becoming less and less affordable to the average person and what that means going forward here. And you got to wonder if this trend is going to slow down. It's amazing stuff. So if you've got stories to share, listeners, as you're buying and selling houses and what you're seeing out there, we're trying to sort of keep up with it. And you can share your thoughts with us this hour. I'll welcome our guest now. Jim Yockel is the CEO of the Greater Rochester Association of Realtors. Jim, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan. Happy to be here.
Lainey Bittner is president of the Greater Rochester Association of Realtors and associate broker at RE/MAX Plus. Lainey, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Welcome to Glynis Valenti, who is the executive director of the South Wedge Planning Committee. Hi, Glynis.
Hello. Thank you.
And Kyle Crandall is the president of the Beechwood Neighborhood Coalition. Kyle, welcome to you.
Great. Thank you, Evan.
Glynis, let me start with you. Any surprise to hear some of the numbers I was tossing out there about the South Wedge? I mean, what's it like there?
Not terribly surprised, I guess. First, let me say that, you know, some of this is due to hard work, and I know that Kyle can probably attest to this too, hard work that residents who have been there for a while have, like, stabilized that neighborhood and made, you know, a lot of improvements from where it was and brought it to where it is today. So, you know, that's kind of nice to see for some people. But, the housing shortage, a lot in the South Wedge, because there are not, you know, swaths of property and there are a few vacant homes, usually the vacancy rate is well under 10% in the South Wedge and for both businesses and residential properties. So they don't even make it to the market. You know, that's what I've found since I've been with SWPIC for 4.5 years. And it's rare when you see for sale signs really on houses. A lot of times these actually stay off the market.
That's amazing.
And they don't come up for sale very often.
And can I say, Glynis, I mean, I appreciate the point you're making, and I hope it's clear that, you know, my disposition is not that any of this is sort of inherently good or bad. It just sort of is.
Right.
But I do want to explore what it means and you know what happens when prices start to kind of reach some of the stratospheric heights they're reaching based on
right.
historical averages. Kyle, what about you? What's going on in Beechwood?
So Beechwood has also seen a quite a rise in terms of our home values, and not just our home values, but also the fair market rental values have also gone up quite significantly within the same time frame. So we have we've been working really hard, Evan, on a philosophy that we have embedded within our neighborhood and all of our work on this called development without displacement. So as Glenn has alluded to, you know, we all want to see improvements to our neighborhood, but we don't want that to be at the expense of having people who would desire to stay in the neighborhood displaced. So all of our efforts have really been, and we've been trying to get out in front of it with some really proactive measures of continuing to see development in our neighborhood without displacing the members of our community that that are so valued by many who live in our neighborhood. And so that's kind of been a part of our focus the last few years.
Is there a singular strategy within the plan for development without displacement?
So I would not say a singular strategy. One of the things that we've been doing is trying to look at things much more holistically, and know that housing is a part of the makeup of a community, but so is education, and so is economic development, and health and wellness, and public safety. And so many times we put things into buckets and just think of them as one single item, but that's really not how communities work. It's really a holistic approach. So that's been one of our bigger, broader ranging. How do we continue to make advances in our community that affect all of these areas and from a holistic standpoint? But I would say, as we really are looking at some of the development without displacement strategies, you know, we have a City Roots Community Land Trust has come, and from a land trust perspective, they acquired their first house in Beechwood in 2018 through the Land Bank Partnership. And to date, the City Roots Community Land Trust has 7 properties in Beechwood that they now have is a means to really try to make sure that we have affordable homeownership, affordable rental opportunities. Another good example, a couple others, you know, Warfield Square, which was built a few years ago on East Main Street, is a mixed income housing complex. And that was something that was important to many of us in the neighborhood, was trying to look at things more from a mixed income standpoint. And a third point that I would try to bring out is, you know, the Rochester Housing Authority had a project on Federal Street, several low-income housing units that they were looking to demolish that were really outdated. And they came to our neighborhood with a plan, and we were able to work together to really work with the Rochester Housing Authority to say, can we reduce the number of units and consider putting a single-family home on the site? And they agreed. And so as a part of that project, there will be an opportunity for home ownership through a current renter who is receiving services through the Rochester Housing Authority. It's kind of, you know, more of a long-term sort of goal. So, you know, small steps to really try to increase home ownership among those who may not have had opportunities to be homeowners are some strategies that we've been trying in Beechwood.
Sure. Listeners, if you've got thoughts to share about all of this, your efforts to buy or sell, what the market looks like to you, and, you know, your thoughts on where that is taking us, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Or you can email us, connections@WXXI.org. Let me ask Lainey and Jim for sort of an overview on what we're seeing here. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that we were talking about it, but I don't... Lainey, to me, this feels a little bit like cryptocurrency. The rate of appreciation is sort of mind-boggling here, and you wonder if there's a correction coming. It has not come yet from what I can see. What are you seeing in terms of where the market is right now?
You know, if I had to say, I'm seeing the ever slightest shift slightly down for sellers and slightly up for buyers. Now, what that means in general in the overall market is that where I had a client who was writing an offer on 26 or was competing against 26 other offers is now competing against 10 or 15. So is that a dramatic shift? Obviously not. And is it significantly better for buyers? Clearly not. But it is a small shift. I personally don't think we are going to be setting up for a huge adjustment or any sort of bubble. I think the difference between what we're seeing now versus 2008, 9, 10 was a significant difference in sort of lending practices. And so I don't foresee a huge bubble burst here. in terms of adjusting the market that much for buyers.
Okay. Jim, what about you?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think what's driving the appreciation mostly is just really strong buyer demand and limited numbers of homes for sale. And you know, we can talk about why there may be fewer homes for sale, but there's strong interest in purchasing homes in our community. And you know, you mentioned before that the market here for many, many decades has been slow growth, steady, not spectacular, while many parts of the country have seen really exponential growth. So, you know, we're starting to see that now. Some of that may be from people who are coming from some of the larger metro areas moving back, and, you know, they've had the benefit of selling a home in a high-priced market, and they're maybe willing to bid a little bit more here, and that skews our prices a touch. But I don't think we're at the point where I would call it a bubble where anything's going to be a major correction, because the buyer demand is really strong.
So, you know, if I could, Jim and Lainey, before we take a few phone calls here, I recently was aware of a house in the city in one of the popular neighborhoods. I mean, there's a lot of popular neighborhoods in Rochester, which is a nice thing. I live in Rochester. It's great. But so this house was, you know, listed pretty aggressively, I thought. I mean, it was listed for just over, I mean, around $250,000. There were, within 2 days, something along the lines of 30, 35 offers, and the smallest offer was for 20 over asking. And there were plenty of offers, well over 50 over asking. I mean, Lainey, is that a surprise at all to you?
Well, not this year, and based on not last year either. We saw, you know, we've been seeing this, Evan, for the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. We've been in the seller's market for about 5 years. And so we've continued to see this progress over the past 5 years with a lack of houses on the market. And we have a pretty steady buyer demand in Rochester. As Jim said, the interest rates being low, people coming in from out of town have only increased that buyer demand, and we've only decreased the number of houses on the market. So I'm not completely surprised. I think the pandemic, we didn't quite know what was going to happen with that, but certainly no. I guess I still raise my eyebrows when I look for the MLS. You know, a couple times a day, and I see something that is listed for, you know, $250,000 that was sold for over $350,000. Over 100,000, right? And when you're looking at there was a $500,000 or almost $600,000 house that sold for 100,000 over asking. So that percentage wise, obviously, is not as significant as something like that's at that 250 point price point. So yes, when I see those 100,000, those are the ones that kind of make me raise my eyebrows and just think, wow, that's a lot of money.
Well,
that's,
and I'm glad you make that point there, Lainey, because, you know, if a house, just in terms of the numbers, you're right. If a house is selling listed at 600 and it sells for 700, it's a lot of money. But that's different than if a house is 200 and sells for 300, or 225 right, and goes for 330. That is massively over the asking. And it sounds to me like, you know, it's not the average, but it's happening with some frequency.
It is. And it's, you know, and it's buyer driven. It's economics 101. It's supply and demand. And we don't have the supply that is meeting the demand that we have out there. And that is what's driving the prices up.
Jim, how often are you hearing stories like that?
All the time. Similar to Lainey, I hear all the same stories. And I guess one different angle I'd like to throw out is, you know, we've been talking in our area for many years about lack of new home construction. And so the builders and the skilled tradespeople have been focusing a lot on remodeling. So when you look at some of these homes who in 2005 sold for significantly less, there's a really good chance that in the last 10, 15 years, they've updated their house, they've improved the kitchen, the bathrooms, and done some investment into it. So there's a little bit more to it than just market appreciation. And at the same time, the HGTV generation has kind of changed the buyer's expectations to, we want our home to be move-in ready. So many sellers are investing significant amount of money into their home before they list it to do all those updates, because many buyers don't want to do the work themselves. So that contributes to some of the higher prices. I'm not saying it's all of the story, but it's a piece of the story. And if you talk to the home builders, they will tell you the remodeling business has been just going like crazy for 5 or 6 years.
Wow. All right, listeners, let's work through some feedback and a wide range, I think, which is good here. Let me start with Andy and Menden. Go ahead, Andy.
Hi, Evan. Thanks. I am a realtor, but I'm also a landlord, and I want to touch on the impact that, you know, the broader fallout from all of this. Kyle mentioned, you know, the impact on rental rates. As a landlord, what I'm seeing is, first of all, last year, the city, 2 years ago, the city did a massive reassessment, and last year they implemented their new tax structure, the new assessment structure. By the way, they did that in an environment where, forward thinking, they might have said maybe we should hold off raising taxes because we're now in the COVID environment. But my properties all have mortgages, and in some cases, my mortgages have jumped as much as $250 a month because of the new taxes that hit last year, and now my mortgage companies are adjusting my escrows. Well, it will take me years before I can recover that increase in taxes that occurred in 1 year through rent, through what will be considered market rent increases to my tenants. When you couple that with the fact that we've had moratorium evictions on top of that, and couple that with the talk of good cause eviction that's coming down the pike, whereby a landlord may be constrained from ever raising rents in any way fast enough to cover the increase in taxes that the city imposed on us, not to mention the typical increase I might put in with new investment, new bathrooms, and regular maintenance. There's a real crisis coming where landlords are going to end up walking away from the rental business because the mortgage impact and the tax impact has become so great, and they can't recoup it. So in the short term, landlords will seek to get as big a rent increase as humanly possible to cover the hit that they took in taxes last year. That's going to drive rent up. A lot of the people that we're talking about in this call that aren't able to buy those houses, they're still renters. So in some cases, those rentals should have been freed up for new tenants because the current tenants bought a house. You know, that whole thing isn't happening. So my point is that I think there's a ripple effect. Sooner or later, it's just going to drive rental prices through the roof, or the growing movement toward things like good cause eviction will force landlords to get out of the business because the dynamics of rent pricing will no longer allow them to sustain what it takes to maintain their property.
Well, so, Andy, before I turn it over to some of our panelists,
yeah.
What do you see as possible remedies from your perspective?
Well, first and foremost, I wish the city had taken a pause on their increase in taxes, because a lot of those landlords that got that huge bump in taxes are also not collecting rent right now in an eviction moratorium. But I don't know what the remedy is, because theoretically, I mean, this is all market driven. As the lack of inventory in the market continues, and you've heard Lainey and Jim say, it's not going away. I mean, there's not going to be any sudden huge influx. I mean, theoretically, unless huge groups of people left the state, thereby freeing up houses, you know, anyone that wants to sell has to go somewhere, and they have nowhere to go, and that's part of the problem. So I don't see that happening in the short term. I think the rent market is going to go up. I think renters are going to be horrified by it. But the bottom line is the cost of housing is increasing. If you choose to be a renter, it's going to cost you more to rent, no differently than if you choose to be a buyer, it's going to cost you more to get into the house. So the overall cost of living is rising. The remedy clearly is going to be from the bottom up. People have to be able to make more money to live.
But
they got to get better minimum wages, whatever. It's
yeah,
an
sure.
Economic
yeah,
issue.
Yeah, I mean, certainly better wages is going to help with this. But when you say the city in taxation, are you talking about the city's reassessment, essentially moving?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
So
obviously the city will reassess again in a couple of years. And they're going to have data that says that the assessments are going to go up another 10 or 20%. On one of my houses, it went up 50%, the assessment.
Mm-hmm.
So as the rising real estate pricing continues to drive up assessments, that the landlords in the city are going to have higher taxes, they're going to have to pass on to the renters, or they're going to get out of the business. If
yeah.
they get out of the business, who are they going to sell those houses to? Out of state, downstate investors who don't give a whatever about what's going on.
I appreciate the real-time edit you did of yourself there, Andy. Thank you. Andy, thank you for the phone call, and good luck to you. I appreciate that. That's Andy and Menden. And so let me turn it over to Kyle first for some thoughts there. What do you think, Kyle? And you might be on mute. Kyle is the president of the Beechwood Neighborhood Coalition. Are you there, Kyle? Try it again.
Yes. Can you hear me?
There you go, sir. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yes, Andy brings up some really good points. I know that for a three-bedroom apartment in Beechwood that's, probably 12 to 15 years ago would probably be market rate of $650 to $700 a month is now $1,200 is the market rate. So those rents already have gone up. And as Andy has indicated, what's to stop it from keep going up? And that certainly is a problem. But, for landlords, there is this crisis, too, between those who are absentee landlords and the only thing they care about is getting a check versus the landlords who are really doing a lot to keep their properties up, make sure that their renters are able to have nice places to live in. And when you do that, obviously you have to spend more money. But with the inflationary costs that are being incurred on landlords, that also does present a problem for our good landlords. And that's been some efforts that we have been trying for years to try to address is how do we try to incentivize good landlords to be able to purchase more properties in the neighborhood to try to stop the investments from the landlords who just don't care about their properties and only care about collecting the money. So Andy's got some really legitimate points as it relates to that, and I wish we had some more answers.
Glynis, what do you think?
Actually, Kyle said pretty much what I was thinking. Surprisingly, in the South Wedge, we're very, very concerned about affordable housing. That being said, we have one census tract that's 91% rental units. People don't realize how many rental units are actually in the South Wedge. It's about 75% rental and 25% homeowners. I agree with Kyle. There are, I feel for some of the good landlords who have, dealt with the tax increases and, pandemic issues with, the moratoriums, the rent moratoriums and things like that. But our community engagement committee has been trying to come up with some solutions for keeping affordable housing in the area. And we have talked with the City Roots Land Trust that Kyle mentioned and, to find out some different options for us. We're finding that people who are older, are heading toward retirement. They've been in their houses for decades and are actually being priced out of their houses because of taxes and fixed incomes. And, they just don't need a large house anymore. And they'd like to stay in the neighborhood where they've spent so much time and where they're comfortable and where they raised a family. And that's harder and harder. So we're trying to, explore some possibilities for that, in either they're keeping their houses and looking at new solutions for that or moving them close by to, rental property or, something where they can get services and everything too. So we're exploring that. But yeah, the rental situation is not good. Although, our numbers are sort of skewed because we have a couple of large facilities, 500 South Avenue and Hamilton Tower with, a couple hundred apartments in these larger facilities there, residential units there. So, but yeah.
Well, and so Lainey and Jim, just real briefly before we get back to listener feedback here, Lainey, what percentage, do we know what percentage of home sales are typically for the purpose of, you know, landlords to rent versus home buyers who are living there?
We don't track that information. We don't track demographic information on buyers, just to avoid any fair housing issues. So we don't have that information in terms of, you know, anecdotally.
Yeah, yeah.
We are seeing our investor community has you know, been a relatively popular community in terms of purchasing. As Andy stated, this past year has really put a huge burden on them, and that has changed. There's a lot more local landlords who are selling their properties to make up for some of the tax increases, you know, if they have tenants that aren't paying. So it is a difficult situation for landlords
so,
right now.
So
you also have investors
Hold on. Let me just make sure I understand what you're saying. Are there more outside investors who are buying now as a result of that?
You know, we've always had outside investments. But yes, I would say that right now that we are seeing the local investors who just, you know, they can't sustain. They can't pay the taxes. And they may be selling the property to someone who's not local. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Jim Yockel, is there a problem with that that you see?
Potentially. I think all the comments I've made are really right on, and it's going to take a wide range of remedies. It's a holistic view to solve some of these. But I think when you talk about the rental market, what's important to note is most of the local housing providers are relatively small scale. They own 3, 4, 5, 6 units, and that's it. And so these big jumps in cost and taxes or interest rates going up impact them, and they're not a huge corporation with thousands of units where they can spread those costs around and still survive. So it really hits the local housing provider hardest. And those are the ones who are doing the most to serve the local renter. And that's a difficult dynamic because we need to understand that there's a balance between having people providing good quality, well-maintained housing at a reasonable rate. And if we put too much pressure on them, then the incentive is, or the financial necessity is, I need to sell. And the only people who are going to buy it are out-of-state, large-scale landlords who may never set foot in the property and are probably more likely to just kind of let it go and not put in the necessary maintenance.
Talking to Jim Yockel and Lainey Bittner from the Greater Rochester Association of Realtors, and Glynis Valenti is Executive Director of the South Wedge Planning Committee. Kyle Crandall is the President of the Beechwood Neighborhood Coalition. And I know we got a bunch of calls and some emails to work through, and we're going to stick right with the listener feedback after we take this only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, kids and the COVID vaccine. Are you comfortable with your kids getting vaccinated? Are your kids excited to finally get vaccinated and maybe move beyond some of the limitations to life during the pandemic? Do you have questions about kids and vaccines, timelines, trials, and more? We will talk to doctors who are helping lead trials, and we will talk to kids who are getting vaccinated next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Charles in Rochester writes to say, I've been working on fixing up my house to sell it. It's not in bad shape, but if I sold it now, the buyers would have to do some work. Should I keep fixing it up and hope to list it for more or sell it now as is? Is there a big expected difference? Lainey Bittner, what do you think?
I personally am an advocate of putting your house in the best condition, your best foot forward, right? So it just depends. Do you have the money? Do you have the time to do that? Because I do think that it's going to give you a better return when you do list it and when buyers come in. Buyers are still looking for those houses that are updated where they really don't have to do anything. So those are the houses that are getting more offers, therefore more money.
Okay. And Kimberly writes to say, and I'll kick this to Jim, do we need to look at the original asking price as being artificially low based on current market conditions? The strategy is to list at a floor price rather than an aspirational price to encourage a feeding frenzy. Is that accurate, Jim?
Partially. I would phrase it maybe that what we've learned in the last 2 years is buyers are smart and they know, you know, kind of what a house is worth. And if you price it too aspirationally, the risk you run is the buyer saying, no, that's a little more than it's worth, and they move on to something else. By pricing it, you know, according to the comparables in the region and everything, and that may lead to bidding wars. It may not, but I think that the realtors have learned pricing it accurately is better for the seller than trying to price it too high and capture this aspirational crazy market.
Okay, Lucia from Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Lucia.
Yeah, hi, and thank you so much for the show, Evan. Sure. Love the topic, and my comments are directed to Kyle. Hey, Kyle, how you doing? And Kyle, first of all, I want to thank you for all the hard work you've done for the Beechwood community and the kids at East High School, because that really is an example of your holistic approach to neighborhood development. And so my question is in your Beechwood endeavor, are there classes for new home owners learning how to maintain a house? Any comments on that? And as far as trying to get more housing, is the Beechwood neighborhood in line, or are there projects coming from the Flower City Habitat for Humanity? And I just want to tack on this comment. In your efforts to get, you know, more housing for the area and avoid displacement of folks, have you guys looked at the Minneapolis model of increasing housing? You know, for example, putting two single standalone houses on one plot. And thanks so much for any questions or any concerns that you air. Thanks, Kyle.
Okay, thank you, Lucia. Kyle Crandall, question. We'll turn it over to you. Go ahead, yep. Kyle.
So, wow, she packed a lot in there. Lucia obviously packed a lot. So let me see, the classes, Beechwood is a complete grassroots neighborhood organization made up strictly of volunteers. We're not a not-for-profit or 501c3. We don't have full-time staff or anything. So we do, though, work very closely with different not-for-profits that have an interest in our community as well. And one of those is Connected Communities, and Connected Communities has come into the neighborhood in the last about 5 years, and they have put together a comprehensive neighborhood plan. And if you go to the Connected Communities website, you can actually take a look at that. And part of that is, of course, some of the strategies from housing and community. What I really appreciate about Connected Communities is, Lucia, to your point, all of the neighborhood work that has gone on, all of the thoughts, all of the plans, you know, that have been worked with the city and such, Connected Communities took all that input from the last 20 to 25 years, compiled that, held a bunch of meetings with residents, and lots of times engaged residents who weren't as much a part of the planning process in the past, and really captured that into a plan. And again, one of those pillars is housing and community. I like the idea of classes to maintain homes, and that's something that I may bring back to the Connected Community staff to be able to do that. In regards to the Minneapolis model of two standalone houses on one plot, I'm not sure that would meet the city's current zoning regulations. I know that they actually, in a recent zoning code, there was some controversy because some of our existing plots that exist right now as vacant lands are no longer deemed buildable. And so that does present some set of challenges when you have scattered vacant plots in terms of what you can put on those vacant lots. That's something would have to be, we'd have to explore that a little further with city leadership. But Lucia, thank you for the kind words, and thank you for all the work you've done in the city as well. We appreciate it.
All right, back to the phones. Calling from the South Wedge, this is Jack. Let me get Jack there. Go ahead, Jack.
Hi, Evan. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Great show. So I guess this, I'd love for the group to address the complexity around especially in the South Wedge, where you have increasing home prices, which I think further drives segregation within the city. And at the same time, you have the previous caller, one of the previous callers, who's lamenting the fact that their rents are getting, you know, it's getting too hard to be a landlord. But that takes away, when landlords are renting, takes away from the community aspect of the neighborhood. One of the strengths of the South Wedge is the sense of community on blocks, the, you know, families that are raising children there. And it's certainly taken away when you have absentee landlords who are just simply bringing in oftentimes college kids, but other groups, you know, to rent for a short-term period. So I guess there's sort of two ends where, you know, it's tragic that, you know, as prices rise, it further complicates, you know, bringing in lower-income families into the neighborhoods. But then at the same time, you have absentee landlords like the caller from Menden, who's, you know, drawing a paycheck off of Rochester, and that money's, leaving the city.
Jack, thank you. I'll start with Glynis Valenti, who's the executive director of the South Wedge Planning Committee, for some reaction to some of those comments. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Glynis.
That is a concern of ours. You know, we don't want to become gentrified, for sure. We're actually the Census Tract 32, which is kind of the northernmost census tract and to the west in the South Wedge, is actually about half and half white to African American, and there's a lot of diversity. There's also an increasing Hispanic population, Asian Pacific population. So, you know, it's actually a kind of a diverse community. It still is, though, you know, a large percentage of white. And yes, we are concerned about, you know, people coming in and again, you know, raising the prices and making it not affordable for people.
Can I ask for a definition? Glynis, can I ask you, you mentioned the term gentrification, and we mm-hmm. had a chance to talk to Tasharda Thomas from New To You Homes LLC. Tasharda couldn't join us today, but she says that first-time home buyers, which are 90% of her clientele, are truly suffering in the current market overall. And mm-hmm. she was part of a group that just launched the Black Realtors Caucus through the Greater Rochester Realtors Association, just hoping not only to help first-time home buyers, but also help identify, you know, I think you made an important point earlier this hour. When you improve the value of your neighborhood, when you improve the houses, when you do a lot of work, yes, values go up, and that can be good for everybody. And I think Tasharda just wants to make sure that everyone's got access. So when you say gentrification, how do you define it, Glynis?
You know, basically outpricing it for lower-income families, lower-income buyers. We are part of the CHOTO program through Home Rochester, and I would encourage first-time home buyers to look into that program at homerochester.org. And they are put through, you know, workshops on budgeting and getting them qualified for financing. There is actually a pool of homes for the buyers in that program. And the woman you mentioned, and I'm sorry I didn't catch her name, she may be aware of that, of the Black Realtors Caucus. That is a program where agencies like ours, and we are a CHOTO, what's called a CHOTO, a Community Housing Development Organization, is assigned a property by the city. Basically, it's a city-owned property, and then the Greater Rochester Housing Partnership purchases that property and assigns it to agencies like ours to do the rehab on that property and to market that property within this group. And they're scattered all over the city. We just actually, our last one was last year, and it was at 171 Averill Avenue, and it's unusual for us to actually get a property in our own neighborhood. They don't come up very often, as I mentioned before. But, you know, that's one opportunity for first-time home buyers
to you know, get into that property, understand what they're getting into also with purchasing a property. And I also just kind of wanted to mention to Lucia, the caller before.
Sure, yep.
I wasn't sure whether she was looking for, you know, maintaining the property as far as financing, you know, financial aspects and things like that. There's a group called NeighborWorks Community Partners, and they are at the corner of South Avenue and Hamilton Street, and they offer workshops for first-time home buyers, for post-purchase clients who want to learn, you know, more about insurance and loans and things like that too. So there's that. And actually, SWPIC, Southwedge Planning Committee, has finally gotten our workshops going. We are doing a series of wedge workshops. And originally, a couple of years ago, these were supposed to be, you know, hands-on workshops like for homeowner how-to kind of things, simple repairs, plumbing repairs, you know, installing a light fixture or replacing an outlet, you know, simple electrical, plumbing, plaster. A lot of these houses are very old. They have plaster. They get cracked. You know, just doing that and allowing people to actually experience that through instruction and see the consistency of the plaster. You know, you can probably go on YouTube and do this, but if you do it firsthand, you know, then it might be a little different. But next week we have two urban gardening workshops going. So, you know, there are some out there, and I would, you know, they're open to everybody. They're not, you know, it's not just for the South Wedge, but those will be coming up, the hands-on workshops and instruction on maintenance will be coming up later this summer as we open up.
All right. Jim Yockel, CEO of the Greater Rochester Association of Realtors. When we take all of that in, I am curious to know if the Association of Realtors views gentrification as an issue to contend with, or is that a byproduct of what the market does and your work is just on, you know, dealing with home sales?
No, it's definitely an issue to contend with. And I love the way Kyle phrased it earlier, as development without displacement. Mm-hmm. And clearly it's great for the community and for the neighborhood to have improvement and have investment and to provide opportunity. But with that comes increasing prices, which then limit opportunity for people to move in or for some of the long-term residents to stay. And that's a real challenge, and it's something that we do need to address. And like all of the issues we've talked about today, there are no simple answers. It's going to take work and it's going to take cooperation. And I think if we approach it as a community, we've mentioned a lot of really great nonprofits, and there are more who are working in this space to help solve some of these problems. The professional community, such as the realtors, the business community, working together with, you know, maybe it's going to take some creative zoning decisions, you know, like Kyle mentioned, to make some of these vacant lots productive. But there's a lot of talk about increasing density of housing, providing the ability for, if it's a large enough lot, to do an accessory unit in the back that could house somebody in 400 square feet, and maybe that's all they need, or finding ways to rezone so larger homes could be subdivided into individual units. There are a lot of potential solutions, but we just need to come together as a community and agree to work on it and be creative in our solutions.
Anything you want to add, Lainey?
No, I think that I agree with Jim and with what everybody else has said, that, you know, there are great programs and nonprofits out there for folks to learn about being a homeowner and whether you're looking to purchase or be a homeowner. I agree with everything Jim said.
All right, let me get Paige in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Paige.
Hi, yes. My sister moved up from New York City after she retired, and she moved into the South Wedge. But when she tried to find a house, she was priced out of the market. So she ended up moving to Witten Village area, and she found a home, and it was high priced as far as I'm concerned. But I bought a house 30 years ago in Dutchtown, and I paid $29,000 for it, and the city devalued my house to $18,000 because of the neighborhood. And recently they just upped it $1,000. But my problem is I'm one of few owner-occupiers in the neighborhood. And when they were talking about investors from out of the country, we're surrounded by that. But the biggest problem I have is that there is a landlord who owns over 40 properties in the city, lives in the suburbs, but doesn't pay his property taxes. Once he buys the property, he just stops paying taxes. And he only pays it when they start foreclosing on it. So I'm surrounded by houses, like the house next door to me is owned by someone in North Africa somewhere, and they have 35 code violations, don't pay the taxes, and these landlords get away with not paying taxes for years, where I pay mine all the time. So I'm just confused by what the city values as far as owner-occupied properties, but they don't take care of the neighborhood, so it devalues my house.
Jim, anything you want to offer there for Paige?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for the city, but I think it's pretty clear there have been numerous studies that show that neighborhoods that have higher rates of owner occupancy are more stable, there's more investment, they tend to maintain their value, and just generally are better for the community. And so it goes back to a little bit about one of the earlier callers was saying, if we as a community don't work with the small-scale local housing provider, the person who owns a double where they live in one half and rent out the other, or maybe two doubles, if we don't make it easier for them to continue to operate in our community, that's what's going to happen. The only people who will then buy these homes are from outside the community, and if they're not here, if they don't walk down the street, if they don't go and talk to the tenants from time to time, that's the kind of situation that can develop, and that's not good for anyone. And so some of these neighborhoods that have seen disinvestment or falling prices of their homes, we need to look at that and decide how can we as a community address this, provide incentives for owner occupancy, and help people who would like to purchase a home but can't quite afford it. Buying a double and renting out a great path to do that. And I don't think we spend enough time talking about creating opportunities for those who would like them.
Kyle Crandall, you want to add anything there?
Yeah, I can share that Beechwood was certainly negatively impacted in the 70s by the exact concept of having a lot of single-family homes that were then split into doubles as people left the city and went to the suburbs. And so we ended up with a neighborhood that was originally probably had about 70% homeowners and about 30% rentals, flipped the other way to, you know, almost about 35% homeowners and about 65% rentals. We did a massive rezoning campaign in our neighborhood to rezone the entire neighborhood back to an R1 district, and have seen about 100 deconversions of two families that were originally built as singles that were then chopped into doubles, and they got deconverted back into singles. Our hope was that process would ultimately lead to more homeownership. We found that that did happen in some instances, but in a lot of instances, those single families also became rentals. So one of our big efforts as well is to try to see an increase in changeover from rentals to homeowners. We value rental properties, but as was previously discussed, you can't have a disproportionate number of rental properties in a neighborhood if you're going to have a healthy environment. So that also this issue is pretty complicated. It really is, and you know, we have just a group of people who love our neighborhood. And again, in Beechwood, it's our goal to have a diverse neighborhood, as diverse as we possibly can, across ethnic backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, where people can live together and just be proud of our community. And that's the work we're continuing to try to do in Beechwood.
It is certainly complex. And, you know, for those paying $80,000 to $100,000 over asking for homes that were listed for $200,000, $250,000, it's going to be very interesting to see if that proves to – well, I mean, look, a home, if it's for your forever home, I mean, people are entitled to spend what they want. But it's going to be interesting to see where values go, if there is sort of a wall hit or if it continues apace with this. Kyle is the president of the Beechwood Neighborhood Coalition. Kyle, great insight. Thanks for sharing with us, and we look forward to the next conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Glynis Valenti from the South Wedge Planning Committee, thank you for sharing your perspective.
Thank you for having me.
Jim Yockel, CEO of the Greater Rochester Association of Realtors. Thank you, Jim.
Yep, my pleasure.
Lainey Bittner is the president of the association and associate broker at RE/MAX Plus. Thank you so much for the insight, Lainey.
Thank you, Evan.
Short break and more connections coming up in a moment.